Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Crossword puzzles have been with us for just more than a century now, but what they were 100 years ago and what they are today are pretty different. We'll talk about the evolution of a crossword later on this hour. First today, consider this for an image that would haunt you forever. Then consider that the man who suffered from it was Edgar Allan Poe. Poe recalled standing in a prison cell and watching as men mutilated and then dismembered the body of his mother. The good news, the image wasn't real. The bad news, Poe really did believe it was happening. It was all the result of his addiction to alcohol. Poe suffered from delirium tremens, the DTs. Understanding that condition led to profound changes in how doctors treated alcoholism. Joining us now is Matthew Warner Osborne, who has a new book out on how early America viewed excessive drinking. The book is Rum Maniacs, Alcoholic Insanity in the Early American Republic. And Matthew Osborne is an assistant history professor over at UMKC. Matthew, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, why a book on alcoholism in early America? I mean, what caught your attention about all this?
Yeah, actually, my interest began when I was an undergraduate, and it was one of those things. I went to a lecture from a professor who I admired a lot, and it was kind of an offhand comment that when in the early industrial America, people drank a lot. And, you know, we know that workers were drinking as much as 20, 22 ounces of whiskey a day. And
right?
It just always stuck in my head that how interesting that was, that drinking had a history.
Yeah.
So later in life, I decided to do some research on it, and I found these fascinating medical journal articles on alcoholic insanity.
Well, what's your hope for a book like this? I mean, what type of contribution do you hope that it makes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the book is primarily written for historians of the early American Republic. That's the primary audience for the book. But it's certainly meant, I think, to, you know, my bigger hope for the book is that it will help us to reflect on how we think about alcoholism today.
And where we've been and where we are today. Two very different things, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's alcoholism as a concern comes about for specific historical reasons. And a lot of that has to do with society and culture. That's separate from the habit of actually, you know, of heavy drinking. People in the 18th century didn't think about heavy drinking as being a medical problem. But we do today, and that has consequences. So hopefully this will be a book that will help, you know, people today and maybe addiction professionals to reflect on how they think about alcoholism.
Well, let's talk about that a bit. I mean, you focus in this book, your focus is something called the delirium tremens or the DTs. Are there other nicknames? And there are so many nicknames for this, I should point out. The horrors, the bottle ache, quart mania, orcs, a gallon distemper, barrel fever, the shakes, or the fear, all great descriptions of the DTs. What exactly is the delirium tremens?
Right. Well, the way we talk about it, the way physicians describe it today is a condition that can result from extreme alcohol withdrawal. So it's the culmination of severe long-term alcohol abuse.
You stop drinking and then things begin to happen to you.
Right. Uncontrollable trembling, nausea and vomiting that leads to paranoia, delusions. And then the symptom that's most commonly recognized or associated with it are vivid hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And that's what doctors found the most fascinating about it.
So back in the early 1800s and even the 1700s, what did American doctors think about all this? What did they think was going on when somebody went through something this dramatic as the DTs?
Right. I mean, that's what's kind of interesting is because in the 1700s, doctors totally and completely ignore this condition. They're very aware that alcohol causes insanity, but it's in the 1810s that all of a sudden doctors become fascinated by it. And their idea is, or the dominant idea, was that the stomach became depraved through repeated alcoholic stimulation, and the stomach threw the mind into a state of insanity. Yeah. So the stomach was thought to be because it was a receptacle of luxuries, that, you know, rich foods and alcohol that we put into it, that repeated morbid stimulation could throw your body into various unhealthy states.
There wasn't any sense then, at least in the 1700s, if I'm right, that alcoholism was was a disease. They didn't know what alcoholism was, right?
Right. Well, I think they recognized that drinking could become compulsive, but they didn't think of that as a big deal, mostly because no one wanted to quit drinking. There was no reason to quit drinking. It's only when in the 1820s and 30s, with the rise of the temperance movement, that sobriety became associated with social respectability, people all of a sudden found it was incredibly difficult to stop drinking. It's typical in the 20th century. In the 1950s, nobody really thought much about cigarette addiction. In the 1980s, 1990s, everybody's trying to quit smoking, and mm-hmm. suddenly addiction has, you know, enormous consequences for the tobacco industry. A similar thing happens in the early 19th century.
So if you were profoundly drunk back in the 1700s, going into the 1800s, what would happen to you? What would, if you're stumbling right. down drunk, what would society do with you?
You'd just be locked into the cell of the almshouse, you know, in the basement. If you went insane, they would just chain you to the wall and let you scream, and they didn't see it as a medical problem. And even if they did, you know, doctors recognized alcohol could cause insanity, but they didn't set alcohol insanity separate from other forms of insanity. Mm-hmm. So alcohol was a leading cause of insanity, along with reading too many gothic novels or going to religious lectures or something like that. It's with delirium tremens that doctors set aside alcoholic insanity as something different, and they begin to study it. And it's that moment when physicians begin to study alcoholics. That's the emergence of the alcoholic as an object of medical interest.
And that's about what, 1813?
1813 is when delirium tremens is first described, and then by the 1820s, hospitals in America are setting aside whole wards in hospitals just to treat inebriates. And it's a really dramatic and quick shift. Right before then, drinking is more of a moral problem. After then, it becomes the subject of medical interest.
Well, two things just quickly here. So if you and I were walking through Philadelphia, which is a focus of your book here, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, we'd be what, I gather from what you're saying, pretty shocked by how much drinking was going on back in those days?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, the average person was drinking about 8 ounces of liquor a day on average. You would drink throughout the day. It's partly because water was very unreliable. So you'd wake up and drink a pint of porter for breakfast. You'd have a little Madeira at lunch. You might have a couple shots of rum punch late in the afternoon. Alcohol was thought to be stimulating. It was thought to keep you warm and cool you down. And I mean, today we've got lots of substances we drink throughout the day to kind of regulate ourselves, monster drinks or, you know, coffee. Back then, you know, painkillers. Back then, alcohol was the most, it was, you know, cured your headache. It woke you
it
up in the morning.
I don't think of the founding fathers as being drinkers. We've sanitized their image over the years. Were they?
Oh, yeah. They were drinkers. They didn't, you know, what we think of as drinkers then was quite different. Like, somebody drinking 8 ounces of liquor a day was thought to be a healthy adult person. They weren't thought to be. Today, we would see them as alcohol dependent. But, you know, George Washington was a huge whiskey distiller. People drank a shocking amount of alcohol. But it was thought of as being part of your daily diet back then.
So help me a little bit more, Matthew, here. And again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about a new book from Matthew Warner Osborne. That book is Rum Maniacs, Alcoholic Insanity in the Early American Republic. And I should point out that Matthew will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. That's the branch downtown, 14 West 10th Street. You can grab a seat by going to KCLibrary.org, and I'll put that information out a little later on too. Help me understand then, Matthew. So if the medical profession is recognizing that there is something to alcoholism back in the 1820s, 1830s, why does it take our society so many decades, even until fairly recently, to sort of, you know, establish this notion that alcoholism is a disease? It's a problem that people develop that sometimes is completely outside their purview. Even until recent decades, we were struggling with some of those ideas.
Yeah, that's a big topic. I mean, the physicians who first popularized the idea that drinking was a disease, they went out and told everybody about it. Doctors played a big role in the early temperance movement. And one of the most convincing arguments was alcohol can become a compulsion. But then doctors refused to treat it because they saw it as untreatable and incurable. And also, they never came up with a convincing pathology for the disease. And this is still true to this day.
A pathology for the disease meaning what?
Meaning they weren't sure how it was biologically that your body became habituated to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Even the early, you know, what we call alcoholism is based on a disease model first articulated in the 1930s. Even back then, physicians never had a strong sense of what alcoholism really was.
They had theories, though.
They had theories. That's right. Most of those theories from the 30s have long been discredited. We have today much more convincing theories related to the influence of alcohol and drugs on the brain and the way that the brain is essentially hijacked by alcohol and alcohol habituation and drug habituation. But even then, even today, people deny the existence of addiction. In polling, you can see 50% of the American public still think of alcoholism as a moral problem. And even then, for people who think it's a disease, they think it's a disease caused by poor choices. So it always it's always sat uncomfortably between a moral and medical solution.
Even today, you're saying we still have that struggle within society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most common effective cure for alcoholism is Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step program, which is not founded on strong science. It's very meaningful. Studies show the more 12-step meetings you go to, the more likely you are to not relapse as an alcoholic. But that program is, it's a quasi-Christian faith-based program. I think it's obviously, I'm not questioning it at all. But physicians studying it haven't come up with an effective treatment other than this kind of, 12-step immersion kind of treatment.
Let's go back to Edgar Allan Poe
and
this hallucination that he had that you begin your book with. I mean, this story begins. It's a hot summer afternoon. Matthew, it's back in 1849. What happens to the legendary Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah, Edgar Allan Poe struggled with drinking his whole life. It was his cousin, I believe, who was very close with in the 1820s, who died of alcoholism also. He also experimented with opium in the 1830s and 40s. This story is he relates in a letter to his mother that he'd been drinking. He had another relapse. He'd been drinking a lot. He believed that men were pursuing him on a train. He jumped off the train and was thrown in prison for public intoxication. And that's where he has these horrible dreams.
And that's a dream itself, what you just described.
But being pursued is a dream. That's
mm-hmm,
right. Being thrown in prison was real.
Okay.
And then he shows up at his friend's house in this delirious state, suffering from this horrible delirium. But you can see in his writing, too, how much of his writing alludes to these kinds of psychological states, hallucinations and paranoia. So a story like The Black Cat is narrated by an unreliable narrator. He's a habitual alcoholic. And we're never sure if this cat is real or not. And his hatred for the cat ends up with him, driving him to bury an axe into his wife's head. For Edgar Allan Poe, alcoholic insanity was both literary inspiration and, something he suffered with in real life.
And critics have said The Raven may have been, his famous poem,
That's
The
right.
Raven, may have been directly associated with his drinking.
That's right. Yeah, that sense of creeping, the sense of disquiet, that there's something wrong that's so apparent in that poem. reviewers at the time thought it was a psychological exploration of delirium tremens.
We're talking about how America viewed alcoholism, the DTs, back in the early days of the Republic. Our guest, Matthew Warner Osborne, his new book is titled Rum Maniacs, Alcoholic Insanity in the Early American Republic. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street, RSVP at kclibrary.org. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. If you want to join our conversation, again, 816-235-2888. Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Matthew, would you share a brief chronology of the interdiction of the state against the prohibition law against the sale of recreational alcohol, and a brief chronology of the positive and negative impacts of recreational alcohol on our civil society?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little outside of my research, so I can't give you a detailed one. But prohibition is passed in 1919. That's kind of funny for us to think about now. But it was in 1919 that there was a constitutional amendment passed banning the sale of alcohol. And historians still argue, was this a success or failure? I think the prohibition is generally considered a failure. It's repealed in 1933. But historians have looked back and seen, you know, there were probably some pretty positive public health outcomes as a result of prohibition.
Such as what?
Well, there's, you know, anytime there's a drop in alcohol consumption, there's enormous public health gains. Alcohol is far and away the most socially damaging drug that our society consumes because it's legal. So this is endlessly fascinating. I mean, in Colorado, one of the arguments about Colorado is, well, if people are smoking more marijuana, will they be drinking less? And if they drink less but smoke more marijuana, that's actually much better for public health.
You can just begin to see that academics are going to go crazy studying states like Colorado now to see, answer the questions you're just posing here. That's going to be fascinating to see.
I know.
See.
It makes me want to be a sociologist because it is really—
In Colorado.
It is really interesting. But with prohibition, the failure of prohibition meant that alcohol was depoliticized. People agreed that banning liquor was totally unreasonable. And the result was our modern kind of conception that we can't limit the sale of alcohol, which I think has not been so great for society, actually.
We can't limit it because it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It's unreasonable.
Which is the same argument being applied in some quarters to marijuana.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. But the consequences of that, I think, are pretty bad. I'm sitting watching a soccer game with my 8-year-old son, and we're watching a sexy ad for liquor, which is a highly addictive drug. I think the failure of prohibition meant that it's much harder to articulate political opposition to something like that.
Florence, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, as you go back in history, then the temperance movement back in the 1830s, if I have my dates right, that came along then. Why? What happened in society that caused that very large movement to kick into gear?
Well, temperance made sense to a lot of different people. The same way, same thing was true of prohibition. The same thing is true with our modern war on drugs. A lot of the kind of grassroots activists were evangelicals who were very concerned about social and moral decay because of a lot of the economic chaos surrounding early industrialization. So they were watching factory workers who were drinking a ton and then going out at night and getting and causing a lot of social ruckus. But the temperance movement was bankrolled by early industrialists who were invested in having a sober labor force. So those were the two of the most influential groups. But those early temperance movements really associated sobriety with social respectability. And so physicians also were very supportive of temperance because it was a way for them to identify and appeal to middle-class patients who wanted to be respectable people. It was also appealing to lawyers and even labor activists who were fighting for, you know, greater respectability for the working man.
That's interesting.
So even, this is true of Prohibition, too. It made sense. Nativists who were upset about immigrants used the temperance movement to stigmatize Irish immigrants and German immigrants as heavy drinkers. So it's always good politics to beat up on drunks and drug addicts.
It's just interesting to me that from a societal standpoint, I'm thinking of my own childhood and watching TV. I'm thinking of Otis on the Andy Griffith Show,
right,
who was a comedic character, always, you know, falling down drunk. Then the Jackie Gleason show. Who am I thinking of there? There was one of those shows where there was a guy who came on every week who was always drunk, and that was to be laughed at. This is just not that many years ago, because I'm not that old yet. You know, it's just 30, 40 years ago.
Well, I think that, like, the one from the example from my childhood, which the consequences of which we're still dealing with, is the crack epidemic of the 1980s, which really stigmatized young black African-American men in the inner cities, despite the fact that crack users were predominantly white.
That's interesting.
And the crack epidemic really warped our drug enforcement laws. I mean, I'm not advocating a point of view here. I'm just saying that that drugs and alcohol are often used to stigmatize the most marginal members of our society.
And that happened why? Why did we come to believe, when most people think of the crack epidemic, they think of, you know, young black youths in the city as the folks who were using?
And it's this, you know, crack was a big problem in inner cities. There's no doubt about that. It was, it was used by people on television and people in politics to advance, the kind of moral agenda of conservatives at the moment. But it made sense to both Republicans and Democrats. For Democrats, the war on drugs is using the instruments of government to solve social problems. For Republicans, it's a get tough on crime initiative. Even at the very height of the crack epidemic, crack use was not nearly as socially damaging as alcohol. So I'm not saying that crack should be legal at all. I'm just saying that often the things that drive our perception of alcohol and drug use are irrational.
Lots of phone calls for Matthew Warner Osborne, his new book, Rum Maniacs. Let's go to Shane from Kansas City, Missouri. Shane, good morning.
Hello. Am I on?
You're on, Shane. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. I have a question for your guest. I got out of the Navy in 1979. We went up the East Coast, and we stopped at the Richmond Edgar Allan Poe Museum.
Yes, sir.
And then we made our way up to Philadelphia. And the lady who was the curator there showed us the two-story Edgar Allan Poe Museum that they have there. And it was the house where he wrote The Black Cat. And she had some comments that you might want to know about. She said that he was tuberculosis ridden, and he dealt with it with laudanum, but that he had a problem that he couldn't metabolize alcohol. So he would try to go and have a shot or two of whiskey, and his mother-in-law had to carry him home because he was under the table already. So I don't know if it was a problem with chronic alcoholism with right. Edgar Allan Poe or any other type of,
right.
pathological problem.
Shane, thank you. What about all that?
You know, I've been to the Edgar Allan Poe house. I actually spoke there, and that house is really fascinating. When you walk down into the basement of that house, you walk down the stairs, and it's creepy because those are the stairs that, you know, the guy buries the axe in his wife's head. You really live the story when you walk down in that basement. I dispute I've talked to the Rangers there, and I kind of dispute their take on Edgar Allan Poe's drinking. They're a little defensive about it, and I think the evidence is that he was a drunk, and that he suffered alcoholism, But I don't think there's any shame in that. I don't think that's something that we should defend him from. And I think understanding that is one way to get better insight into his wonderful stories.
We're out of time. I want to thank Matthew Osborne, again, an assistant history professor at UMKC. His new book, Rum Maniacs, Alcoholic Insanity in the Early American Republic. And you can see and hear Matthew tonight at 6:30 at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. To grab a seat, RSVP at kclibrary.org. Matthew, I really enjoyed the conversation. You did a great job.
Thanks so much,
Steve. Thanks for coming in.